system.
The principal.
Don't make fun of my microphone.
As long as it works, huh? Sure, why not?
I want to make sure I can hear the man. So I'm going to ask you some questions, but you're the expert on this stuff. I'm asking you the wrong thing. You tell me that's not important. We'll move on.
Okay.
But maybe just can you say your name? Your birthday name?
My name is Philip Simmons. My birthday is 5443. I lived here 67 years. And my address is 32237 Highway 23, Empire, Louisiana. 70050.
Now, is your family from here?
Yes.
Do you know about how they came to get here? How long
they've been here? They've been here since in the 1700s. So I don't know all of it, but I know, my... One of my great uncles, the last one buried in the Point Pleasant Cemetery across the river, was buried in 76. He was 90 years old.
So, what kind of work has your family done down here?
Well, they fish oysters and shrimp and crabs and trapped and for many years. They even hunted the ducks and stuff, you know, years ago when it was legal, you know, for the market. And then they worked in oil field. My dad worked for Freeport Sulphur Company. My old uncles built boats and had a shipyard and a sawmill. And we used to cut wood. And I used to go with one of them, Uncle Joe. We'd go up the Mississippi River, and they had the big cypress trees would come down with the big roots on them. And we used a passepartout, you know, the cross cut saw. And we'd cut the roots off, and we'd roll them in the river and tow them down the river, and then pull them up on a couple pile and put them on a dock where the sawmill was, and he'd roll them, and when you get 4, 5, 6 of them, whatever, then he would cut the wood up, then you'd take it out and dry it. He had to stack it so it would dry, and then he would use it in the boats, you know, to repair boats or build boats.
So you've been working with the land your whole life, huh?
Yes, pretty much.
What, can you tell me what it was like growing up in that kind of environment?
Well, you run around barefooted. I could cross oyster shells. It wouldn't hurt my feet, and I can't walk in the grass. But it was nice. It was a lot slower pace. And my old uncle and them had wood stove and iron pots. And they cooked over there, and they would start something off in the morning, cook all day. And that was your breakfast, lunch, and supper, you know. And but it was a good living. And I trapped when I was a kid for fur, you know, mink and otter and coon and nutria rats and stuff like that, muskrat. And and then we fished oysters by hand in them days with rakes. And, you know, we lived off the land pretty much. We had cattle, goats, pigs, chickens, you know.
When you were growing up, did you always know you were going to stay here your whole life?
Not really, but I mean.
Did you think maybe you wanted to leave?
Nah, I don't think so. I'd had left some. I went on a 4-H trip one time to Chicago, Illinois, when I was in high school, and that was really the first time I'd really been far away from home, you know. And I, you know, it was good to get home. I just, you know, you always want to come back home, I guess, you know.
Could you, it's a hard thing to put words to, but could you sort of describe what makes it different down here that would make you want to stay?
Well, my family's been here for so long. I was born and raised here, and I fished and shrimped and oystered myself. I just sold my boat last year, my big boat. I had 5 at one time and over 1,000 acres of bedding grounds. And we used to trawl, my wife and I and the kids, you know. And then I worked for Southern Natural Gas, and if I couldn't get there early enough in the evening, I'd send the wife and kids out in the bay, and they would put the boats and get them ready and start catching shrimp. Then I'd take another boat and go meet them, and we would shrimp most of the night, you know. We'd done double dipping, I guess you'd call it.
Bill, how about the technology of, like, not just, like, how much harder it was to do the work, like, put those pilings in and, like, you know, now diesel machines. Can you explain?
Yeah, well, back then, they used to build bridges, my uncle and them, for cattle to go across. For the wintertime, they would go out in the marsh away from the river further to get marsh grass to eat in the winter. And they put all these bridges in by hand. You had blocking tackles and a come along, and you pushed them down. You picked the other part of the old bridge up, pushing the piling down till it went so far. Then you bolted it, you know, and it was all hand done them days. And you put an A-frame up to stand it up, you know, and block and tackle. with ropes. So.
Is any of that work that you worked on still up and standing?
Oh yes, yeah.
So it lasts, survived all the storms.
Yep, some of the piling's still stuck in the ground. It's about all that's left is the pilings, but it went through Betsy in 65, Camille in 69, and Katrina in 05, plus all the other not quite so bad storms.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about what it's like to live down here when a hurricane comes?
Well, it gets a little rough, but I stayed here for Betsy and Camille, but I did leave for Katrina, and I'm glad I did because my house was gone. For, I think it was Betsy, I was working for the Department of Public Works at the Ustrica Locks. I was assistant lockmaster. And so my dad and my great uncle, the one I was telling you died in 76, was up here in the old house in the front. And I went down to check the water, the locks in Empire. And the water come up, I got jammed. So then I was standing up in the lock house up to my knees in water. There was seven of us in there. And a barge come up next to the wall and stopped. Lucky it didn't knock us, come on across and knock the house down. We'd probably lost our lives. But at that time, there was an old man got caught out there, and I saved his life, old man Bowers.
How did you do that?
They had a life ring, and I threw it across, and I could see that he had one of those little night lights, you know, the hand lights, and it was going in and out of the water, and the water was rushing over. And I threw that ring buoy out there, and it caught on a nail on a piece of metal. And he come across that rope. We held the rope and brought him across.
And this is in the midst of the storm?
Midst of the storm. Water was so... It was terrible.
What kind of damage did your family see during Betsy?
My dad's house wound up back here by where the new road is now. It wasn't in then. And my house up front moved about 6 or 8 inches off the blocks. And the roof went off. And we had spent quite a while putting up stuff. You know, we figured, well, if the water didn't get too high, we would come back, you know, but we didn't get wet from the bottom, got wet from the top, so.
You want to get that?
No, I'll just cut this off. 757-615-63, I don't know who that is. Let me write that. Mom, write that number down for me, please.
What is it? He's got a pad right here.
There you go. I don't know what that is. That's got to be one of your buddies, Drew.
Blaming it on Drew, huh?
Yeah, oh yeah. Got to be media.
Bringing all of us down here. So were you able to save the house?
Yes, we moved it, got it back on the blocks, and we put a new roof on it, and put another porch on the front because that had blew off. And my dad's house, we jacked it back up, brought it back up front, and built the foundation and repaired it too. You know.
Now is that you did that all yourself?
Yes.
Or did you have
my dad and yeah, just mostly me and my dad.
Did you get any help from anyone? Red Cross or the government or?
SBA helped us. Yeah, uh-huh. Red Cross didn't help us, but SBA did lend us some money, and then before we could get that paid, Camille come along. So then they lent us more money, but we had to pay the first loan off, and then they lent us more money for the second go around.
So you ended up in some debt to the federal government.
Yeah, but they forgave us some of the money, so you know it helped.
They had that loan forgiveness bill.
Yeah.
That came out,
mm-hmm.
Right? So, tell me about Camille and how that compared to Betsy.
Camille was, I don't know, probably a little bit worse than Betsy was, but it didn't cover as big area, and it went more across the tip and went on over into Mississippi more, you know. But we had a lot of water, you know.
Mm-hmm. Did that mess with your house too?
Oh, yeah.
What happened with
Camille? It flooded, as usual.
Mm-hmm.
But Katrina was worse than Betsy and Camille put together.
So what happened?
They had 20-something feet of water here for Katrina. I had a boat of my neighbors was up in an oak tree, 15, 20 feet from the ground.
Can you, what made you stick it out through all those things, right? I mean, it seems like someone might have left.
Well, I guess, you know, they've been through many of them before, and my family and I don't know, they had bad storm before that. They had one before my time in 1915 storm. And people move back, you know. And some of the people move out, and then you get more people move in. So, but we've been here so long, and it's just home to me. And, you know, a lot of people don't know there's any place below New Orleans. You know, we're 60 miles below New Orleans. And I just, Well, I got cattle, and like I say, you can live off the land. If you really, you know, want to work a little bit, you're not going to go hungry. You can shrimp, you can oyster, you can fish, but I don't know what all this oil spill is going to do.
Yeah, how are you facing that?
Well, day by day, I don't know. I don't know what to think. I'm trying to get a job with the BP, but I put my application in, but they haven't hired me yet. You know?
What kind of job would you like to do for them?
Well, anything. Pick it up. I got some little barges we could use to put oil booms on or fuel tanks on or whatever they needed, you know? And I got some little boats that I could push them with. And one of them's got spuds, and the other two is just little deck barges, you know?
How long have you been waiting to hear back?
Huh. Quite a while. I don't know exactly, but I guess 2 or 3 months. It's, yeah.
Why do you think that is?
I have no idea. They got people working that I never heard of down here from all over. And the local people are not getting to work, some of them, you know. Some of them, they got some local people working. Some of them got 2 or 3 boats working, and I ain't got nothing working, you know. It's just, I don't know how, what's the problem?
What, you must have seen the oil industry sort of get bigger down here across your lifetime, right?
Oh, yeah, it was really booming back in the 50s and 60s, 70s, you know. It was, I mean, it was really rocking and rolling, and it, jobs was no problem. You could quit one today and go to work somewhere else tomorrow, you know, or the next that evening. But of course, it's not that way anymore. A lot of your major companies, with all the rules and regulations, have moved out. So it's more little independent companies here now. And the ones that are here is like BP and all. They're more offshore. You know, they're in the deep water. They're not in the inside no more. Of course, it's depleted some too. You know.
What do you think of someone who's using sort of the natural environment here? You know, you're raising your cattle and you're out in the beds. What do you think of the oil industry?
Well, I don't have that. I mean, I made part of my living on the oil industry too, you know. And there's a lot of people here make a living on the oil industry. And I think they shouldn't put that stop on the oil, moratorium on that, you know. But I mean, yeah, it is an accident. They had accidents, deep water. They're having a problem taking care of it. But, you know, I mean, how many airplanes crash and kill hundreds of people, you know? And it's an accident. I mean, you know, it's just an accident. So why punish the oil company and the local people that work for the oil companies and all these service companies that service them, and they're putting a lot of people out of work. And the country's already in bad shape.
What, can you tell me a little bit, just thinking about the oil industry? How that work changed over time for you?
Well, it just, it got slower, you know, as years went by, it got slower, but, man, I remember at one time in Quarantine Bay, there was like 300 wells, and the Gulf Oil Corporation had it then, and they had, you know, several places. They had Gulf, Grand Bay, and West Bay, and Black Bay, and all over, you know, and then they sold out to Chevron, and then, of course, Chevron sold out some of their, most of their fields of shallow water to different companies. And Pennzoil bought some, I believe, and this one and that, and then ConocoPhillips. And then first thing you know, they're selling out to somebody else, and they've changed names. So you know, now it's just little independents, a lot of them, you know. And they've pulled a lot of those wells that, you know, they no more fuel, no more oil there, and they've pulled them out.
Does that have any effect on you when the companies keep changing everything?
Not really. I mean, I'm kind of retired now, but you know, they've done a lot of improvements, you know, stopping little leaks and pollution in the water, which is good. But, you know, I think they're going overboard with it now. You know?
So.
Well, they, you know, if they drop one little drop of oil in the water and you know, they want to fine them big money and all this stuff. And, you know, some things are going to happen when you're working. I don't, the one that don't make a mistake or don't have any problem, they don't do very much. That's my opinion.
Mm-hmm. What, you said the word pollution. Has the situation with like the wildlife and fish populations, has that changed here over time?
Yeah, but I think, of course, I guess I'm bad, but I think the wildlife and fisheries hurt us more than they help us a lot of times.
Tell me about that. How so?
Well, they just like they don't know what time to do the season like they should, you know, and they got all kind of rules and regulations, and I guess you got to have some, and the population's so much bigger. When I was a kid, you could go anywhere and go fishing, and they never had no limit, or they didn't have nothing, you know. Of course, I'm sure you got more population now. You got to have more rules and regulations and stuff. But I'll tell you, when I was a kid, you could take a white rag on a hook, go out there and throw it and pop the cork and catch speckled trout. That's how good it was. Okay. Yep. You didn't have to have no bait.
I'm a fisherman, so that sort of excites me, the thought of doing that.
Yeah. And, I mean, when I was a kid, we caught fish, you know. Of course, we didn't waste it. We caught what we needed, you know, and if we caught more, we'd throw them back, but we just caught what we needed, brought them home, cooked them, and you go back the next time and get you some more, you know, keep it fresh.
It wasn't people going out and catching way over the
No. Head. Whereas now, the people, some people, they want to go out there and kill them all, you know? So that, I think back then, people kind of conservation their own self. They wasn't greedy, and there wasn't as much, you know, they didn't have all these big fancy restaurants and all that, where they could sell them and make big money out of it either, you know? I don't know. It just changed with time, I guess. Just like all the fancy stuff they got now with electricity and all that stuff. I was telling somebody a while back, they wanted me to get an architect to build this house. And I said, man, I don't need an architect. I know how to build it. I said, I can understand I maybe need an architect if I was in a subdivision where I may damage somebody else's property. But if I ain't got smarts enough to build it not to hurt myself, you can't protect me from myself, you know? So anyway, I built it, and then I had... An architect had to come look at it and draw it up and make sure it was okay before they would sign off on it to get my permits. And he did, and he was impressed the way it was braced and stuff.
How did you learn to do that?
Well, I pay attention when I'm doing things. You know, I look at what people's doing and watch how they do it. I build barges here in my yard, you know, myself. I just comprehend while looking at things what you need to do it. And
can you tell people who are listening to what they'd see if they were looking around your yard?
Probably Sanford and Sons with all the junk and stuff I got. But I got cattle and I use tractors and stuff for that, you know, and I got machinery, I got bulldozers, I got a track hoe, I got four or five different tractors and bush hogs and auger and all kind of equipment, you know, and that's how I operate because that's what I use to do a lot of the work, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's cheaper for me to buy it and then maybe rent it out some here and there than it is for me to go rent it, and then I got to turn it in and it's dead money the way I look at it.
That's right. So you're saying that you hate it when you see something get thrown away?
Yeah, I'm a pack rat. But, you know, I just, this is like this church that they were tearing them down. I tore the church down for nothing, just for the lumber. The guy that was tearing it down was going to just destroy it. I said, man, look, this wood's too good to just destroy. You know, we don't have any trees left now. We're going to just keep throwing it away.
What?
All of this house you see up here, all that floor, I tore a house down, cut the floors, cut the joists. I did 2x12x6, 18 foot, I think, or 20 foot. Anyway, I cut them out in 10 foot sections, and I put it back up here, and I put it back together, and that's how this house is built.
How long did that all take you to do? This is all post Katrina, right? That
you after Katrina, this? Yeah.
How long did it take you to get back on your feet?
Well, I'm not on my feet yet, but, you know, I work every day, and I'm too old to do a whole lot, but I got a couple guys that help me, and I point, and sometimes they tell me, ain't you tired of pointing? But, I get the job done, and I got it in my head what I want to do, so, you know, of course, so now I got to make notes because I'm getting old and forgetful, but, and then I lose the note, but.
You seem like you're still doing okay to me.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I do all right, I guess, for my age.
Do you think, are there other people, if I were sort of going up and down the highway here, would I meet other people who are living the way you do, or are you sort of unique at this point?
No, I guess, you know, maybe a little bit unique with all the junk I got, but you got a lot of people here that's been here a long time, and, you know, they were more or less brought up the same way I was, and I know a lot of guys here that fish, that's all they ever done for a living is shrimp and oyster, you know, the Stapelkoviches, that's all they ever done, and they fish pompano, they trawl, and they fish oysters and you know, stuff like that. But, yeah, they got a lot of people here that done that for years and years and years, you know. And I think I got an article somewhere here where in the 1915 hurricane where a lot of people come from Europe, Yugoslavia. And they worked oysters and it was in Grand Bahia and stuff, and a lot of them got drowned for that hurricane. And it's pretty good history. And like I say, I got, you know, people used to live on the other side of the river. I can take you and show you a cemetery over there. And they call it, it's the Point Pleasant Cemetery. It was a settlement there at that time. And there's quite a few people buried in there. And some one guy in particular that I remember, it was buried in 1844, and he was from Flensbury, Denmark. And the plaque, the tombstone is there, you know, and it's still there. You can take a picture of it today. And another thing that's unique in it, they got a petrified tree tombstone in that cemetery. So it's very unique, you know. And of course, back when I was a kid, it was more or less hard ground. And when my old uncles and them was living, they even had places where they would dig the, hill up the grave sites, because they would knew there was people buried there. Of course, that was before my time. And since then, I don't know where all them little grave sites are. So I just kind of try and keep the grass cut in it and things like that. But they got some tombs and stuff in there, too, and copings and stuff like that. So, and a lot of them is the families that I recognize, you know, and some of the, I know four or five different people that's buried there. I know my Uncle Joe, which is my Uncle Sid's brother, he's buried there. Uncle Sid was last one in 1976. And then Mr. Tony Cose, Mr. Isidore Cose, and some of the Hingle family, and one of my old school teachers' family, Miss Claire's family, is buried around where that petrified tree tombstone is. And like I say, it was high land then. Now it's starting to get to be a little marshy around in it,
yeah,
you know.
Tell me about erosion around here. What's going on with that?
Well, the islands are disappearing, and it is eroding quite a bit. And I guess you take all the minerals out the ground, and, you know, it's going to crumble some if you don't fill the voids. And I think that's part of it. Plus, you got the water levels coming up. So between the two, you know, it's getting underwater quite a bit. And the erosion from these hurricanes and stuff and not having no repairs too much is, you know, it's hurting the coast. We're losing miles and miles and miles. When I was a kid, you couldn't see across the marsh out here. It was so thick, you know. All you had was bias. Now it's all open water back here.
Whose fault is that?
I don't know. Maybe it's Mother Nature, I guess. I don't know if it's really anybody's fault, but... Like I say, you take all the minerals out of the ground, sulfur, oil, and gas, and so that's going to crumble it some. And then, we probably some of the fault for putting levees up along the Mississippi River so it doesn't run over and silt up and keep building, because now it all goes out the mouth of the river, you know, because of the levee system here on the delta. So I guess you can call humans part of it, but I don't know. You got a lot of stuff out there that could, if they would have done it a long time ago, it probably helped a lot quicker, but they're waiting too long. They got to do too much studies. They raised $3 million to work on the beach out of Empire here.
Who's they, by the way?
The government. Mm-hmm. You know, gave $3 million. Mm-hmm. Well, they spent the $3 million studying how they were going to do it, you know? And to me, that's silly. Spend the $3 million on the project, then study how you can improve it. And that's the way I operate.
So, is that the local government that's doing that?
No, that was the federal government. Yeah, Corps of Engineers or something. I don't know exactly who it was, but I know I heard they were spending $3 million and they wound up spending it all in studying. That's just like these Barry Islands. They was building them up out here by chandelier and all. They stopped all that, from what I understand. Hey, when it's going to hurt, let it build up a little bit, you know, and protect the land a little bit. The tide used to come in. It would take all day to come in. You get a norther, it would take a day or two for all the water to get out, you know. Now, you get a norther, 8 hours, it's all gone, you know? It's all gone in a day. So that tells me, you know, all your canals is all, there's no more canals, it's just all open water, more or less.
Why do you think they're getting it wrong? You're sitting out here and you're looking at it and you're seeing the mistakes the government's making. Why are they making those mistakes?
I have no idea, you know? Just like they're bailing out the car companies and the banks and all this stuff. If I go bankrupt, that's my problem. They're not going to come help me. I'm an individual. If that car company goes broke, they're not doing too good of managing it the way I see it. So if you getting $10 million bonuses at the end of the year and you've done a poor job, I don't think you should get that $10 million. You know, that's my opinion. And if you go bankrupt, then so be it. You better hire a new manager. Yeah, there's a lot of it in the pocket, but it's so smart today, and I don't have no education, but they are so smart today that they got to study everything and think everything out. There's no common sense. It's my problem, what I figure, you know. It don't take brilliant guy to figure out, hey, this is washing away. What can we do to stop it, you know?
So how do you think the situation being handled with the oil spill?
I think it's a joke. I mean, they just throwing money away like it's crazy. Same thing I think about after Katrina with FEMA and Road Home and all that. All these FEMA trailers, from what I understand, these little boxes cost $60,000 to put them on location. Then it costs another $5,000 or so to haul them off. Why not give everybody $60,000? Go buy your big trailer and say, hey, this is it, bro. You better take care of it. And they would have got by a hell of a lot cheaper.
Did you get one of those trailers?
Yes, I did. That's what you in right now, one of the bigger ones. But I went, I got a box first. And they let me have that after I fought for a while, because I lived in a truck body across the street after the hurricane for months, trying to get a place to stay here. Because they had their people in here cleaning up, picking up stuff, and they were stealing a little bit you had left. And I was hot. And they had them walking around these little white suits, picking up paint cans and stuff. They took my oxygen and acetylene bottles. They took everything. And tanks, fuel tanks and stuff that I used for the farm, they took all that. And so finally I moved back, and I told them, don't even get on my property, get out. So I run them off. But eventually I went to the parish president and different ones, and they finally gave me one of them little boxes. And my wife had come spend a couple nights in that truck with me. She said she wasn't coming. Of course, we didn't have any electricity, no running water, no sewage, no nothing, you know. And hey, I can survive. I'm a survivor. You see that survivor on TV? That ain't nothing. You know, I mean, I hooked up, I got a welding machine, I got it running. I hooked it up, I had lights. I got me electricity with the welding machine. I got me a hot water heater, I put me a shower in, you know, and hey, I was uptown. I got a little gas stove, and I could cook, sleep, eat, wash, go to the bathroom. I had a little porta potty deal out there, you know. And
so how long did you live like that before you got the house where you could move back?
Oh, I lived in that truck for how long, Mom? About 6 months or more.
Probably.
Over 6 months.
And how long till you came back?
After that?
Well, when we got that little box, FEMA trailer. Yeah,
so,
and we put it out here.
Okay.
And then went to the church. The church was supposed to be giving them through FEMA. And then the preacher that collected the money got in trouble with dope and stuff. So some of the people got them and some didn't. And I was in the first 50. You had to put up $2,200, $2,300, something like that. So I put it up for me. I put it up for my son, one son, and my daughter, and my younger son went and bought another trailer. So he didn't get nothing. He never got nothing from FEMA, and he never got nothing from Road Home. And then my daughter never got nothing from Road Home, and neither did my other son. And he finally, well, the preacher went to jail, and he lost the $2,300 so far. So we had to go through another deal that they, because he was in the top 50, and they gave us a trailer from somewhere else. He just got it, what, about 2 weeks ago, Mom? And we had to put it in Pearly Hatch because it's a zone, it's a V-zone here now. We moved ours in, but now FEMA changed the rules, so you can't put it here now. You got to put it somewhere else. And it's no better over there than it is here. It's just a bunch of crap.
So just so I understand, it's 5 years after Katrina when he finally got this thing that was supposed to help him out.
Yeah.
And then you were told where you couldn't put it on land that your family's been on for
right.
how long?
Hundreds of years.
Hundreds of years. So that's how they're helping you.
Yeah. Ain't that nice? So anyway, we set it up over there now, and he finally got his trailer, but we had to put up the insurance money and stuff again. And I don't know what's going to happen. I guess we're going to lose the money on the other one, but...
Did the insurance, how did that process go?
Oh, I didn't have insurance. I don't buy insurance. I had insurance for Betsy. Of course, it wasn't home. It was homeowners insurance then. It wasn't flood insurance.
They didn't have flood insurance.
No. And they said, well, that's a flood. We don't pay for that. So I said, yeah, and I ain't buying no more insurance. And I had to buy it when I got this trailer because that was part of the FEMA regulations, you know. So I bought it. And then we got another little storm and it damaged it. And the insurance did pay off for that. You know, of course, they paid the... I don't know, the church or wherever, and then we had to get it from them to do it. But finally, to make a long story short, they kept wanting me to give the little trailer up. Well, we got this trailer. But they never would give me the titles, because they said we'd get the titles to it after a year. So I wouldn't let him pick the little trailer up until he got the titles. Finally, he got me the titles, and then I let him take the little trailer.
So the insurance you had to buy, was that homeowners or flood insurance?
Flood.
Flood insurance.
Flood. I think it's flood and contents, you know, yeah.
I'm just thinking about all that. That's quite a story.
So, I can tell you some stuff here, you know. It's amazing, you know, what all went on. And I could show you some pictures. I got pictures of my house, what was left of it and stuff, where I lived and stuff. I got that all in the album in there. Some of my cattle. I lost 600 cows and 43 bulls for Katrina.
Out of how many that you keep?
A little over 700. I got salvaged about 100 head. And they were all on this side of the river.
They find some high ground, didn't they? How did they
live? I don't know how they lived. You know, some of them, I lost cattle over here that were standing in water after the hurricane. I seen them. But what am I gonna do? I can't get it to them. I can't do nothing about it. They ain't got nothing to eat, nothing to drink. The water got ran, you know, bad, nasty, dead fish and stuff. And I mean, it was pitiful. They just starved to death.
And you had to watch
them? Yep. Nothing I could do. Now, finally, after the water finally did get out, they brought us some feed and hay. The Louisiana Cattlemen's Association helped us quite a bit afterwards. And the Department of Agriculture finally come in later. But as far as I'm concerned, the Department of Agriculture didn't do a very good job.
So tell me about the Cattlemen's Association that did a good job. Who is that?
That's all of the Louisiana Cattlemen's Association. You got different parishes belong to the... Like I'm president of Southeast Cattlemen's Association, which is Orleans, St. Bernard, Jefferson, and Plaquemines. And then I'm also a member of Lafourche Parish organization. But Bob Feldner and Robert Joyner and Danny Cole and the Smith boy, what's his name? Nicky Smith. Nicky Smith brought me an 18-wheeler milk truck somewheres, and we didn't have no running water. So they brought me an 18-wheeler full of Kentwood water that Kentwood donated to them and brought it here and parked it on the driveway where I had that truck body over there where I was staying in. And I could water the cattle on the levee, and I also had water to take a shower or drink, you know.
Why do you think the Cattlemen's Association was so much better prepared to help than the government was?
Well, I don't know, but they were ready to jump in. And we had help from all over the United States from different cattle associations. You know, Kentucky, Utah. I mean, all over the whole United States, cattle people. Department of Agriculture, their departments helped our Louisiana Cattlemen's Association and the Department of Agriculture, I guess. But Bob Feldner and Robert Joyner and Danny Cole and Clayton Brister and some of those people and Nicky Smith was the ones that really took the ball by the horn, bull by the horns and come down here and said, hey, what do you need? What can we do for you? How can we help you? And they brought feed, they brought hay, they brought water, you know, and that's what we needed.
Or
no.
They just sort of came down here?
They sort of came down, and of course, I was in Lafourche, I believe, cattle before that, but I mean, I didn't know a lot of them people, and they come out of the goodness of their heart to come help us. And not only did they do that, but people in Kentucky and different places donated bulls to help us get started back down here. And when the people from Kentucky come down, I don't know, a year or two later, and we had a cookout at Fort Jackson for them, took them down to one of the Vietnamese docks and had shrimp and stuff with them, because they also cattle people up here at Citrus Lands, and showed them, you know, how where the bulls went and how some of the ranches, they wanted to see how they was doing and what was what, you know. And it's amazing that in my house, I had my grandma's mandolin from years ago, and it had went for Katrina. It had went all to pieces, and it was a keepsake. It was from my grandmother, you know, and so I took all the parts and I put it in a 5-gallon bucket. I said, well, maybe someday I might find somebody that would be able to put it together. Well, when that group come down from Kentucky, it just so happened that a guy on the bus that donated some of the bulls built mandolins, and so I asked him about it, and he said, well, let me see what I can do. Let me know and I'll get it and see what I can do with it. Because he lives in Kentucky And then he goes to Florida in the wintertime, and then he goes back in the summer to Kentucky. So anyway, he wrote me a couple letters. I got with him, and sure enough, he put that mandolin back, almost complete, all of the same old mandolin, just a couple little bitty pieces that he had to change. And he put it all back together. It looks like a brand new one. And he was going to mail it back to me. I said, no, I'm coming to Kentucky and get it. So I went to Kentucky, and I went to some of the cattlemen's meeting up there, and they were happened to go to Utah to see a cattleman's outing, you know, the bus vacation or whatever you want to call it. And I told them that I had been there to go to that gold and copper mine there. It's deeper than the Empire State Building down in the ground. And I went to see that, and I told them about it, you know. And it was nice, and it was really, and they had a cookout while I was there, and me and the wife went. And it was very, very good. And also, they got some people here in Louisiana that donated me, Mr. Coy Fitch donated me a registered Charolais bull, and Mr. Dow Richard in Cairn Crow, Louisiana, donated me a registered Simmental bull. So we still have some good people in the state of Louisiana that was willing to help because they wasn't hurt at that time, you know. And they helped me and they helped other people, you know, to get back on our feet a little bit.
Are there lessons that you learned or that other people should have learned from some of those earlier disasters that could be applied now with the oil spill?
Yeah, I guess, but main thing is, of course, the oil spill's a completely different thing. You know, the hurricane comes and it goes. This oil's going to be here a while. And I don't know whether you look what it's done in Alaska, you know. And I'm hoping that they get it stopped and so it don't kill everything in the Gulf, but I don't know what's going to happen there. I think they're doing wrong by putting this disbursement on it and sinking them, because they should let the oil come up and do like in the old West. Instead of circling the wagons, circle the ships. Put oil booms inside the ships and then put these suckers inside to suck the oil up off the water. So what if it's 2 foot thick? You know, you can keep pumping it up and getting it out and getting the oil off the water. And don't let it come all over the Gulf. I don't know why. That's another thing. Why not do something simple? Keep it simple, stupid. That's my motto. You know, circle the wagon. And all the ships they got and all these barges, they could have circled them a couple miles if they had to. And like I say, you put a ship, and if you can't put them too close because they could bang and damage each other. But you put a cargo boat or a big offshore boat in between them off the ways, and then you run your oil boom from the ship to the cargo boat along the side to the next ship. And you keep doing that all the way around the circle, and the oil wouldn't even get out.
So if you want to share this good idea with somebody, is there someone who's going to listen to you?
Nah, I doubt it. I'm just a dumb country boy.
Dumb country boy who built his own house and has survived through multiple generations out here.
Yeah.
So.
But I use common sense. I don't have no education. I don't have not a bit of college. Don't even have a good high school education, as far as I'm concerned, but I got a little common sense.
Are you seeing oil right here yet?
Yeah, not in my pasture, but on the east, on the west side here, I took people out and showed them oil in Bay Baptiste and around Port By and Grand Lake area.
Now, I went out of Grand Bayou last week and saw some, but could you describe further?
Yeah, there's some out there by Grand Bayou, too.
Can you describe sort of make a word picture of what it looks like to see the oil?
Well, it's devastating. I mean, you poor birds get in it and get dying, you know, and wherever it's washed up on the marsh, the grass is going to all die there, you know. And how do you clean that up? The only thing I know to do is wait till it's over with, because you don't want to go and do nothing before. And then when it's finished, you spray it down with something and burn it right on the edge, burn the grass and oil off, and maybe the new grass will come up through in the dirt, you know. If not, you're going to lose more erosion. And if you get any bad weather, it's going to put it everywhere.
What do you think is the best case scenario for moving forward from here? What's the best outcome that could happen?
For the oil?
Yeah.
To get it closed off was the best outcome, but like I say, the best thing they should have done, in my opinion, was to circle the ships and then keep it there. Don't let it spread all over the country, you know? Don't let it spread. But it's too late for that now because it's all over the Gulf, you know.
So what do you think is going to happen? What's the most likely thing?
I don't know.
I'd like to ask you to describe what you thought it was going to be like down here next year or 5 years from now.
Well, that's hard to say. I mean, you know, it depends on what this oil does. And the thing is, they sink it part of it, and It's not gone all the way to the bottom. Some of it's maybe part the way between. Some's all the way down. So you're killing everything. You leave it on the top, you only kill stuff on the surface that comes to the surface. As far as the oysters and stuff that's down on the bottom, if you leave it on top, it probably wouldn't hurt it too bad, you know? But if you put it on the bottom, it's going to kill everything. Now, I know that we're going to have a lot of dead oysters here because they opened up all the fresh water, the locks and the freshwater diversions and everything, and just opened it all up because the river's up. And it's to keep the oil away from the coast as much as possible, and which is a good thing, I guess, you know. But the fresh water's going to kill them because of that, you know.
So you think you're going to harvest any oysters?
None. There won't be no oysters for a few years, I don't think. If they come back, you know. I know I won't be able to fish any now. If it don't get too on the east bank, I know I won't. But on the west bank, me and another guy's got 145 acres, something like that. We got together, and if it don't come in too far, we might salvage the oysters there. You know.
Have you put a claim in to BP?
I did today. I went to today and I showed them my bedding ground papers and stuff, and I had sold my big boat in 08, so I didn't fish much last year, but I got my commercial license this year, but I didn't get it till after the oil spill was there, so they looked at that and said, well, that's after the spill, you know. I mean, I've been buying it for 40 years, you know, but I mean, it don't matter.
I don't mean to pry into your personal finances, but are you and I keep hearing about people who get this problem where they didn't report stuff on their taxes, trying to get a claim, and they can't substantiate it.
Well, I brought my taxes with me. So I brought 6, 7, and 8 with me.
So you've been paying your taxes?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because apparently a lot of people don't.
Yeah, well, a lot of the fishermen used to do that. And in the old days, you know, they paid a lot of the fishermen cash, so they didn't report it, you know. But now they got their Social Security number and all, or whatever they sell, they got to report it, you know. They turn that in, and if you don't report it, well, you're liable to get caught at it, you know.
Yep.
So.
You mentioned you have 3 sons?
Two sons.
Two sons
and a daughter.
Okay, 2 sons.
Yeah, I got.
Do they all live down here?
Yeah. Matter of fact, my son's suffering from that a little bit. He works for Empire and Hayden Fisheries. He's in the warehouse, but last week the boats didn't work at all because of the oil spill. And I think they went out last night. They leave on Sunday night, but they got to go all the way on the other side of Morgan City to fish because all this out here is closed, you know. So I don't know what's going to happen there. And a lot of these oil field service companies and stuff is hurting. And I mean, I'm fortunate. I'm retired. I got a little income, you know. I get my Social Security and stuff. So, you know, I guess I ain't going to go hungry unless they cut Social Security out. But I guess, you know, I'm fortunate. But I always kind of looked ahead in life a little bit, you know. That's why I worked in the oil field, and I shrimped and fished oysters. And I got 2 companies, Simmons Marine and Simmons Farm LLC, both of them. And plus, I worked for Southern Natural Gas as a boat captain for 23 years. I worked 10 years at AIDS Navigation. And, you know, and while I was around all over the Gulf, I was watching things being built and stuff, you know, and I watched shipyards building stuff. And I just paid attention, and I figured, hey, if they can do it, I can do it, you know. And I have. I got some pictures of some barges I built here and stuff.
How long does it take to build a barge?
Well, depending on the size, but about what we took, Mom, about a month and a half, 2 months.
That's it.
Not 2 months.
Yeah.
Wow.
But you got to get all your steel together. And I mean, I'm not doing it by myself. I got a couple welders working, you know. I don't really do much work anymore myself. Mm-hmm. I get other guys to do it, but I'm there showing them what to do, what and how to do it.
And you
know?
Design the whole thing.
Yeah.
Now, and you said you sold one of them.
I sold an oyster barge. It was 16 by 40 with a 671 Detroit. All aluminum.
Can I ask you a stupid question? Because I just don't know that much about this. But can you try to walk me through a day in an oysterman's life? I mean, like, what?
Well,
can you tell me a little about the actual daily work that goes into it?
Well, usually April, they start, the state has reefs, and they call them seed grounds. And they'll go out and fish oysters. And then you got leases from the state to put them on. You go get your seed oysters over on the east side of the river. And they got a couple other places, and that's where I would go mostly, and bring them on this side of the river or even on the other side where you got state leases, and you plant those oysters. And then depending on the area, you can maybe harvest them in 8 months, 6 months, whatever, you know, depending on how they grow. And
now when you plant them, how do you do that?
You go over there and you dredge the seed oysters up. You got a big dredge you drag alongside the boat. You pick it up and you wash it back with pumps, or you shovel it back in the olden days more, but now they mostly use pump. But anyway, you put it back, and then you come on this side of the river or wherever you're going to put them, and you got some boards. You pull out a pen board. They open up, and then you take the water and you wash them back overboard. And you could ask my wife about that. I took her before we had pumps, fishing oysters, seeding. And we shoveled them back then. And after they shoveled back all day, we come over here and said, now you shovel them overboard. Which is a damn good day's work, I'll tell you.
Really?
Yeah, that is work. Of course, now it's, you know, they're improving things all the time. And they wash them off and wash them on. It used to shovel them off the table back. Now they use the water depression to push them back.
Is something lost when you don't do it the old way?
You lose some. Yeah, there's a percentage of loss, but I don't think it's too bad, you know. But you do lose some. But even when you're shoveling, you're going to lose some because they knock the bill off and stuff when you throw them, you know.
So do you seed your whole bed in one day?
Oh, no. You do that for maybe 2 months every day, you know. And every day that you can work, as long as the weather's not bad. And you may put 30, 40, 50 loads of oysters in the water, depending on how many days you work.
And how many oysters are in a load?
Well, different size boats carry a different amount, but mine carried about 800 sacks.
Okay, and how many are in a sack?
100 pounds, roughly, probably about 24 dozen.
So that's a lot of oysters.
Oh, yeah.
So then how long, once you seed them, how long do you leave them there?
Well, it usually takes 6-8 months, you know, because they got to grow to big enough market size. They got to be 3-inch, really, to be market size. But some areas grow faster than other areas, too. But, I mean, we've bedded, and maybe they didn't grow good enough the first year. We wouldn't wait till the following year to fish them. And I fished 300 sacks in one day on a boat.
So tell me what it means to fish them. How do you get them out of the water?
You do it the same way you're bedding, but they're just bigger. But you got to clean it. You know, when you're bedding, you're just washing them back. Mm-hmm. But when you're picking them up to sack them, you got to knock the dead ones off. Any shell in there, you get rid of it, anything, you know. And then you put the good ones in a pile or in a basket, and you sack them up.
That's all by hand?
All by hand.
And is it just you, or who are you out with?
Oh, no, you got 2 men on each table. You know, you and 1 man on one side, usually, sometimes you only use 3. The captain will be work both tables and 1 man on each table.
Mm-hmm. And how long does it take to fish them? All the ones you put down in the spring?
Depending on how many you bed, but I mean, it takes, you know, months of work.
So how are you able to do that and raise all these cattle at the same time?
Work. It's not, and I mean, the cattle are beef cattle. You don't have to be there every day, mm-hmm. you know, but
So tell me, can you describe to me what goes into the way you told me about being an oysterman? Tell me a little bit about the work of the cattle.
Well, that's the worst part of that is hurricanes, because then you got to build your pens back, build your fences back, get your cattle back where they belong. Matter of fact, I'm still not finished building pens from Katrina. I got one pen, what we call the island pen, to build yet. I got to finish one up at Ballamuck. I got to finish what we call Black's pen, and I got the island pen to build back yet. And the other pens I got down the road, I got 2 more down the road, one that we call a Wild Bunch, one we call a Terminal pen, and those are pretty well built. But I built them out of steel this time. I got some pipe, and I built them out of steel and welded them up. I'm hoping that'll, because the wood, I guess from the wash of the waves, it washes the piling out the ground, and the wood and everything leaves.
Well, I'm thinking about building back stronger. Maybe for the microphone, you can tell the tape how high up we are right now.
It's 20 foot to the bottom of the floor joists on this house. And then you got 12-inch floor joists, 2x12s. And then I got 2 double layer of 3/4-inch plywood for the floor. And it's all 2x6 studs and 2x8 ceiling joists. And I got a tin roof, you know.
So you feel secure?
Yeah, pretty good. But I'm not staying for another one like Katrina. Now, if it's only 100 miles an hour winds, I'll stay, you know. Right. I stayed for Betsy Camille, but I can't, you know, I'm getting old. I can't do what I used to do. So my wife usually makes me go now. That was the first one I left for, was Katrina. But And I'm glad I did, because I might not be here talking to you today. I know I got a couple friends drowned, you know. A couple of them Scarabin boys, and also Charles Martinez, Charlie Martinez.
Where'd you go?
Where'd we go, Mom? We went to Lafayette. And then Rita come along afterwards, and we had to leave Lafayette. And we went to Missouri. I got a sister in Missouri, and they got a dairy farm. And so we went up there, and I had some shrimp in the freezer here for my sister. So when I left, I took the freezer. And we went to Lafayette, and then we wound up leaving Lafayette and bring the shrimp to Missouri to my sister. I think we had like 300 pounds of tails, you know, quite a bit of shrimp. So, oh yeah, she was happy to see me. Of course, she always is. And usually I go up there and I have a shrimp boil in May every year for the church, to raise money for the church that she attends. And but this year I didn't get to do it with the oil spill and all. They had closed the season, so that's the first year I missed in about 10 years or more.
How did your sister end up in Missouri?
She married a guy from New York, and then the taxes got so bad up there they left, and they come to Missouri, and they bought a farm there. And she was married before, and he was married before. Well, he had 4 kids, and she had 2 when they got together. And then they wound up having 2 together. So they got his, hers, and ours, I call them. So they wound up with 8 kids. Yeah, and the youngest boy now is, he's a grown man, but I mean, we call him a boy. But he now is helping them to run the farm. And they got over 1,000 acres there. And I bought a little land with them, but... they got over 1,000 acres, and they milk every day, and every kid when they was coming up had their chores to do. And I'll tell you one thing, I think he taught them well, and all of them went to college except the youngest boy that's running the farm. So, and they've done good for themselves.
You think she misses it down here, though?
She did for a while, but, you know, they've been there 20-something years in Missouri, and she's made new friends, and yeah, I don't think she'd want to leave. No, she wouldn't want to come back.
Do you have other family around?
Yeah, I got another sister lives up front, my youngest sister, her and her husband, and their kids all married. Now, they got one, she works for Mississippi River Bank, and she lives in Jesuit Bend up there. But, I don't know, somewhere there, close to Billy Nungess up here, I forget what the name of it was. But anyway, and then she's got 2 other kids, and they both in Missouri, though. So, they...
You got this Louisiana-Missouri connection.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. But, I mean, it's nice up there, too. You know, they got deer and turkey and stuff to hunt. But, it's you know, I go up there and spend a week or two, and I'm ready to get back here, though, because they don't have enough water there for me. There's a lot of lakes and stuff there, but it's not salt water. And I don't know. I just used to that salt water, I guess. So
it's got a certain smell, doesn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, and here we got fresh water and salt water. We got the river fresh water and some freshwater ponds. And then we got the Gulf on both sides of us. So, you know.
So, some people who have never been here are going to listen to this interview. They're going to hear you talk about Betsy, Camille, Katrina, oil spill, 1915, all this stuff. And they're going to say, all right, well, salt water, fresh water, but... there must be something more than that that makes you want to stay here, despite all that. And what would you tell them? People say, oh, you know, he should just leave. It's not safe.
Well, no matter where you go, you have disasters. You know, you got tornadoes. You got earthquakes. Look at Haiti or whatever it is, you know. I mean, hey, you got danger anywheres. And at least I know it's coming with a hurricane because it's on the, you know, it's advertised on the radio and the television. And I can track it pretty close. And I do. And if it looks like it's going to be a direct hit, Phillip's leaving. before, I didn't care. I'd stay. I'd send my wife and family out. But I would stay. My dad would stay. My old uncle would stay, you know. But and then everything's subsiding. And you know, it seems like the disaster getting more rougher than they used to be. And I personally, I think if the good Lord's trying to tell the people something, then they'd better heed the warning. You know, it's just too much corruption and too much bad stuff going on.
Is there any way to put to words what it does to a person to rebuild their house 4 times like you have?
Well, I told her, she didn't want me to rebuild this time because we had this trailer. But I felt like, hey, I don't trust FEMA. They might come back and say, hey, we're going to take the trail. So I started this, and we had this here, but I never could get the title. So I started building this. I drove the piling, like I said, on the outside here. I had them drove with a guy with a pile driver. Then I dug a ditch with my machine and put 12 by 12 sills, bolted them to the piling, and covered it over. We call that a mud sill. And you do that in the marsh so that your camp don't sink. So I done that, and then I went to see about a permit. They said, well, you can't build a house without an architect. I said, okay, I want to put a roof over my trailer. So I drove the pile and put the mud sills in. I took this old house down, I put the floor up there, and then I started putting the walls up. Well, that was a mistake, because then they come and say, hey, this is not a roof over your trailer, this is a house. I said, well, I went to see about a permit for a house, and you said I had to have an architect. I don't think I need an architect. And we went round and round, and they actually cut my electricity off where I'm living here. Took the meter and cut it off at the pole.
That's the parish government did that to you?
Yes, because of FEMA regulations, so they say. And I got on the phone and I called the parish president. I told him, you better get my electric going. I'm losing my groceries. And if I lose my groceries, they're going to be a killing in Empire. And I didn't name no name, but I meant business. And when they come to cut the electric on the next morning, I was sitting on my porch with a shotgun. And that guy said, man, don't shoot me. I'm just following orders. And I knew the guy. And I wasn't going to shoot nobody, but I was mad, I'll tell you. And and it's just, like I said, if I was maybe going to damage somebody else's property, I can understand that. But I ain't got nobody within 400 feet of me, so I'm not going to hurt anybody but myself if I hurt anybody. And I'm not that stupid I'm going to hurt myself if I can help it. So don't mess with me. Let me do what I got to do on my own property. You can't build a house on your own property? What is the matter with this country? Where's our freedom of choice? You know, it just doesn't seem right. They can tell me what I can do and what I can't, but I'm paying taxes every year on it. I bought the land. It don't belong to me. I pay for it every year. I just don't think it's right. It's just like an automobile. They sell these automobiles for $30,000, $40,000, $50,000. The guy that buys it pays tax on that money. Now, he trades it in. The next guy that buys it, he pays tax on that same automobile. And if they sell it 10 times, they collect taxes 10 times on it. That don't seem right. Once the taxes is paid, it ought to be over with.
Mm-hmm. Do you see those tax dollars being put to work for you?
I see them being wasted by the federal government and sent it overseas. They got people going hungry in this country and they're worried about feeding them overseas.
So you believe take care of us first?
Take care of the American people first. We out there, our men and women are out there getting killed to file freedom. Why? Where is our freedom anymore?
When do you feel like it started to go bad like that?
I have no idea. It's just been getting, started a long time ago, and it's just getting worse and worse and worse and worse. Well, the old Russian Khrushchev, I believe, said he'd take this country over without firing a shot, and he's doing it with dope and all that kind of stuff. People are going crazy.
When you were building back after Camille, did you have to deal with permits and licenses and the way
you... Oh, yeah.
Same thing then.
Yeah.
And Betsy, too.
But it wasn't as bad as it is today. Yeah, we had to get a... I don't know about Betsy. That was in 65. But I know in 69, we had to get some permits. But it was minor stuff. It wasn't nothing major. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to have an architect, I don't think, then, and all this stuff. But, you had to have proper sewage, which I can understand. And you had to have... your water line and gas lines, tested and stuff like that, the electric. I can understand that. But don't come here with all this stuff. You can't do this and you can't do that,
Can you tell me, it sounded like part of the problem was with the parish government.
Yes, it was.
Can you tell me about what the parish government's doing wrong as opposed to the federal government?
They just following FEMA guidelines that's laid out for this parish because we got help from FEMA, or the parish did.
So it's the federal government, you feel like, is tying the hands of the parish
yeah.
government to be a certain way.
Yes, I do.
Now,
I think communism is in this federal government.
Tell me about, I don't know too much about old man Perez, but you must have seen him, right?
Yep.
Now, what was it like when he was in charge down here?
Well, he took care of the people here. I'm not saying he wasn't a crook. Mm-hmm. Just like Edwards, I'm not saying he wasn't a crook. But the people liked him, and he took care of his own people. And I don't see what they done. It was totally right, but they looked out after the people here. They didn't worry about what the government was doing, and they didn't accept the government funds like they do today. And I guess, you know, that's, of course, times change, and you can't do what you used to do back then, you know? And I understand some of that. But I think they go overboard with a lot of this stuff, you know? Yeah, we need conservation. Yeah, we need this. And right now, in the South, you got to have a permit in New Orleans area, all along the Gulf Coast here. You go to Missouri and still build an outdoor toilet without a permit, as long as you don't build it near a stream or a pond. Now, what's so hard about all that, you know? You don't need a permit to build a house. You need, when they get finished, they come check the electric and stuff in it, and they give you electric and you're there. You don't need a permit. Now, you may need it in the cities in Missouri, but I'm talking about out in the country like this is. You don't need a permit. A permit? What's that?
So there is something different. Oh, but it's the FEMA money you're saying.
Yeah.
It's the federal funding.
The federal funding.
Makes the local government have to behave a certain way.
Right.
Think is really
and bad. They put all these rules and regulations on them, see?
So if you had your way.
I tell the federal government to shove it. That's if I had my way.
And you would rather?
I'd rather battle it on my own.
No federal funding.
None.
But some freedom to do it as you think.
That's
right. Do you think,
that's my opinion. Yeah, you know, the thing is, these people that's making all these rules and regulations never come up like I did. We had board houses. There wasn't no studs in them or nothing. You had a plank board on the wall with a crack in it that you put a strip of wood over the outside. And then you went to the grocery store and you got cardboard boxes to nail on the inside so you could keep your behind warm in the wintertime. You know? And we had a wood stove and stuff. We didn't have electricity back then. And when we got a butane ice box, we was uptown. You know? We had an ice box. They had made an ice house and they had a beer. So you go get a 300-pound block of ice. And my old uncles and them had a box in the sawdust what they got from the sawmill. And you better get caught in that box because you was in big trouble. But that was the icebox for the whole week.
So tell me what you learned coming up like that. They missed by not.
You learned how to do things the hard way and the simple way. And you didn't have all this modern stuff. You done it by hand. You done, like I said, with the passepartout, you cut the logs by hand. You had a handsaw. You had a bracing bit that you drilled a hole with. You know, you didn't have all this electrical tools and all that kind of stuff. Mortar, what they call them things that make them fancy cabinets and all that, miter.
Oh, yeah, big
cutters.
Box,
and,
so, yeah.
Yeah. And you had a box, what they call a miter box, to cut your 45s if you wanted to put molding on the inside, you know. And you know, they had a lot of molding in. And just, most of your house was just plain walls, you know, mm-hmm. plain wood. Mm-hmm. And it was painted. If you had a floor, it might have been mud, you know. But like I said, they never come up with hard times like I did. You went to the store and actually got cardboard boxes and nailed them on the wall to keep you warm. That was your insulation. And in the newspaper, that's what they used to put in the ice to keep the ice insulated. We used to trawl, and that's what we had a box that we'd put newspapers on the ice and stuff to keep it cold and keep from losing the ice to keep the strip cold. I caught as much as 2 barrels of shrimp a day with a 3-horsepower Firestone outboard motor, and we come in, and they didn't weigh them. They had a basket they throwed them in, and they throwed them in the truck and went to the French market. If they sold them, you got your money. If you didn't sell them, they went to waste. You didn't get paid.
Gave you an appreciation of how to do things.
Yes. And like me and my old Uncle Joe, the one that I told you his brother was buried, we used to go fish oysters by hand. And when the tide would be in the low in the wintertime, I would go out and pick the oysters up, bring them to him in the boat, and he would do the culling. Then we'd come in, and we'd throw them in a spot that was clean with nothing but shells on the bottom, you know, small shells, what was a bedding area, put them back overboard. Go back the next day, do the same thing, come back and put the other ones right there with them. Do that for a whole week. Then we'd go out and fish them up with rakes, put them in the boat, then pick out any ones that was dead out, sack them, and then we'd come across the river, and we might get $3 a sack for them. And you talk about work. And you had a push pole down the bay when it was tide was high, you know, to get out. Man, they don't know what work is today.
tasted?
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay.
They taste different than they do today?
No, I mean, they were good, you know.
Do they taste different just because you've done the work by hand, though?
You appreciated them more, I guess, you know. There's still a lot of work today, even, you know. It's more modern, yeah, but it's still a lot of work. That's why I sold my boat. I'm too old. I can't handle that no more. And my oldest son got kind of mad at me, but...
You got mad at me for a while.
For selling it. Because he wanted to inherit it, more or less, you know. And he said he might want to go work it. But my son's kind of half crippled up. He fell off a boat and got his back messed up some. So he can't really do too much. So I had an opportunity to sell it before, and I didn't sell it because he wanted me to keep it and all. I said, okay, I won't sell it, but you're going to have to help me in the winter, you know, when we pick the boat up to clean it and paint the bottom and take care of it, do the maintenance on it, keep the batteries charged, you know. And he wouldn't come help me. And I told the wife this time, I said, hey, look, he didn't do anything. I'm out there doing the work myself. She said, sell it. So that's what we done. We sold it.
Can you tell me what your two sons and your daughter do?
Well, I got two sons and one daughter. Yeah, my daughter is a security guard with security. My youngest son works at the Pogie plant. He's a warehouse man. He takes and checks keeps all the fuel for all the boats, the oil and the filters and all the parts and all that kind of stuff. And then my oldest son works in the oil field. He's T2 certified. He manages oil platforms. And right now he's unemployed.
You think they're gonna want to live their lives out down here?
I think so. Of course, my oldest one's 30, what he was, 33, Mom? 34? Youngest one is 33 or 34.
33, just made 33.
Yeah, born 7/8/77. So, so he's, and that's what he's doing in a warehouse, and he likes that, you know. And they make, you know, they got pretty good jobs, I guess, you know. So they make a living, that's what counts.
You think you were able to raise them with an appreciation for all the things you're talking about that you were raised with?
Some, but not as much as I know about it, you know, and I don't think they appreciate it as much as I did because of the way I come up, you know. Of course, I guess, like every family man, I guess, you know, you want your kids to do better than what you had, you know, and you try to help them get along, you know. And like my youngest son has cattle with me, you know, and he works with me and helps me when he's got time off, you know, and in the cattle pasture. And of course, he's got his own to take care of out there with me, you know. So, but I would like to see them do better, but I guess every father wants to see their kids do better, you know. So, but they do all right, I guess. I can't really complain. You know, they're not on drugs or stuff like that, so I guess I'm fortunate in a lot of ways. But I try to teach them, you know, hey, look, you know, sometimes things are going to go bad, and they're going to be in bunches like bananas, so you better be prepared. Oh, I ain't worried about that.
But I'm going to be able with the museum, you know, to try to get some people to be able to hear this interview. And is there something that you'd want to say? You know, if America was listening from Empire, is there something that...
Well, I would like some kind of historical society or something to help me with that old cemetery across the river. Because, you know, I'm the only one left, and I'm 67. And I don't think my kids is going to take care of it. And I had promised my old uncle, Sid, he died at 90 in 1976. And I promised him I would take care of it as long as I could, you know. And it needs another fence. The hurricane tore the fence down. I had put a chain link fence around it.
Does that cemetery have a name, by the way?
Point Pleasant Cemetery. Yep. And that is the community settlement there, Point Pleasant. As there were several towns on that side of the river in them days. Before the 1915 hurricane, almost everybody lived on the other side of the river. And then after the storm was so bad in 1915, a lot of them moved to this side of the river. But they had also a train that run back and forth on this side of the river, and they didn't have one on the other side. But you did have the old freight boats that run the El Rito and the New Majestic, and they would come down, and they would go all the way to the mouth of the river, and they would bring goods down, and then they would also pick up things like going up, like my old uncle used to... be like a broker with these diamondback terrapin turtle and ducks and stuff like that. And they would stop and pick up. They would be in barrels, and they'd put them on the freight boats and send them to New Orleans. And I think they shipped them to China. I don't know where they went, but that's what I understood. But that was a little bit before my time.
Did you learn this all from your uncle, by the way? From him telling you?
Well, I learned from him and a lot of the old, and I work with all those old timers, so it showed me, just like building boats and stuff. My old uncle used to take it. He had a steam, what he called a steam box, and these old luggers had a, you know, the board would start out like this, and it may almost turn all the way in the back, and the fantail would come back. And he had was a box about, I don't know, 12 or so inches wide and probably 12, 14 inches deep. And in them days, the old 55-gallon drum was built real, real heavy. And it was kind of a round, oblong deal. Anyway, and he had the big bong. He had coming up into that box, and he'd put oyster sacks in each end. Then he'd build a fire around it, and that drum would be full of water. And he'd build a fire around the drum and make steam. And he'd put that board in there, and he may steam that board all day long. And when he took that board out, he would start near to go put it on the boat and start. It was all cut and ready to go. And he'd start putting it in and twisting it and nailing it and with the old C-clamps and tighten it in and get it all in place. And that steam, you could twist it, you see. He might soak it 2 days before he put it in the steam box in the water.
Mm-hmm. Any of his handwork still around?
Not that I know of. I don't know. I think I got rid of that too. I had an old motor that come out of one of them. It was a universal engine, they called it. And it was gasoline, and it run off of dry cell batteries. And it had what they call a Model 8 coil and a timer, advanced timer. And it was in a little oyster boat. And my uncle had gave me that oyster boat. That was my first boat. And I kept it. Well, I lost the boat in one of the storms, but I had kept the motor here up until Katrina. And I think I sold it for junk iron, because it got all rusted up and everything. But, you know, it's just been a unique life, and it's enjoyable. And that cemetery is something to really see. I like to see with the petrified tree and the old, you know, dates. And I'd like to see somehow some historic deal to kind of help to, you know, preserve it.
You know, I'm a historian myself, and sometimes people ask me, curious what your answer is, why it's important to keep this stuff and know about it.
Well, you know, I know about it because, you know, when it's been there since I was a child, and it's got sentimental value because my family's there, of course, but there's other families there that's got sentimental value, you know, and everybody is, you know, just about of that time period is all gone. Miss Claire was the last one living, and she used to, that was one of my school teachers, her family was some of her family, and she used to send me $25 every year to help keep the cemetery clean. And she was the last living one, and she passed away a few years ago now. But she was the last living one to send money to you know, to support it. But they were, like I was telling you, there's several towns. You go up on the east bank there, you got Bohemia. It's a Bohemia plantation, and that's where my mother was from. And their family owned land in what they call the Bohemia Spillway now, coming down the river. And there's a cemetery up there also. The last time I was there, the only thing sticking out was the little wrought iron fence around the pickets around the top and part of the old church. But that's been 40 years ago, so I don't know what's left now. But then you had the Humble Camp, which is further down, and Humble Oil had a place there at the end of the road in Bohemia. That's it. You can't go no further by road. And then you had Nesta, Daisy, Haspel and Davis, Nicholas, where my uncle and them used to live, and Point Pleasant, which is where the cemetery is, and it was donated by Narcisse Cosse. I forget what year. I had the titles to it before Katrina. I lost them in the hurricane. Then you got Ostrica, Fort St. Philip, Auger, and then you got Powlettown, Port Eads, and all that going on down, you know.
And this was all, is anyone still out there on that side?
Powlettown. There's still some. I guess Port Eads, I'm not sure about that. But Uncle Sid left the other side. When I was young, there was Uncle Sid lived over there, and he was in the family home, William Peter Johnson estate. And Uncle Theodore Johnson, which was a cousin, lived a little bit, maybe half a mile below him. Then Mr. Isidore Cosse and Mr. Tony Cosse had one. Mr. Isidore was, both of them was outside the levee system there. Uncle Sid was outside, and Uncle Theodore was on the inside the levee system. And when I was a kid, my great uncle had cattle too. And I used to go in the summer and cut the grass with a little tractor, you know, in the cattle pasture. And he paid my Social Security and made sure I was working. He was very, I guess you call it instrumental in kind of showing me the things about life, you know. And he told me, I'll never forget one time, he says, let me tell you something, son, you can fly high, but you got to come down to roost, remember that. And I did, I remembered it. But and then Stricker, up until, you know, maybe Betsy or Camille, there was people still living there, and Olga too. But they all, I'm pretty much all out now, you know. I don't think there's anybody at Olga, nobody at Ostricker. Mr. Earl used to have a store. There was a store in Ostricker. And Pilottown, they had a school. They had the voting machines down there. They had quite a bit of families lived down there. Then they had the Delta Duck Club, I'm talking about years ago, when my uncle was hunting and all that. And that's where they used to go kill ducks and stuff, you know, for the market. So,
I'm amazed that you know that you can sort of light up the river and know who was everywhere. Could,
oh,
you,
yeah.
Could you do that today? If you drove by, do you know who's in every house?
Not every house, but I know a lot of them.
Pretty well.
Yeah. But the houses are mostly gone from the hurricanes, you know. But they had a post office at Algo. They had one at Nicholas. Yes. But, you know, like I say, I spent a lot of time with my uncles over there in the winter, in the summertime, you know, when I wasn't going to school, cutting grass and stuff. And he had the shipyard. One uncle had the shipyard, and he would saw the logs and build the boats and repair boats. And the other uncle, he was kind of a, I don't know, he was more like, he went and got the ice. He went to the grocery store once a week. He had a little boat. He would run on this side of the river. And he had some property over here where my son works now, with some of his property. And like I say, when he was younger, he'd done a lot of stripping and trawling and fishing and trapping and all that kind of stuff. But he kind of had retired when I was fooling around. But he still had his cattle. So he was raising cattle more than anything else. And I would help him cut the grass and keep stuff. And I mean, in them days, he had an old cast iron pot. He would cook on that stove in that cast iron pot, and I can still taste it today. It would be so good. It would be all day cooking on the stove. You know, it might be ducks or goose or muskrat or whatever it was, you know, chicken. And he'd cook a big red gravy or something with spaghetti and get too dry, add a little water to it, you know. And it was, I tell you, things was at a lot slower pace then. And people, you know, like on Sunday, people would go visit, you know, other family members and stuff. And you don't see much of that today. I had, on my mother's side, I used to go to my grandpa Tabney's. Of course, they had cattle and chickens. They raised chickens. And back then, they was able to sell the eggs to the local stores. So they would candle them and make sure there were no blood spots in them and all that stuff. And of course, they didn't have any roosters with the chickens. And we would go deliver dozens of eggs, big old dozens, several dozens in them stores, you know. And he had a, on his farm, he had some orange trees, but he had a pecan tree, a fig tree, and a pear tree. Pecan tree, fig tree, and a pear tree. The whole place was planted like that. And then he would sell the whole crop to like some of these companies. They would come in and pick all the pears, or they'd come in and pick up all the figs, or they'd come in and pick up all the pecans. Plus, he sold the eggs and raised his own food with the chickens. And once in a while, he might raise a pig and kill it. And then he had the beef, you know. He was raising cattle. So people lived on the land, more or less, you know.
It seems like you've seen so many changes.
Oh, a lot,
and
yeah.
So many challenges.
Yeah.
You think the oil spill is a big deal in the context of all that?
Well, I think it's bad, yeah. But, I mean, what you going to do? You know, it's an accident. It happened. It's an act of God, I guess. You know, you might, I mean, maybe it ain't an act of God, but it's a, Mother Nature will take care of itself, eventually. It may take a while, but I think Mother Nature will take care of itself.
Do you have hope for this corner of the world here?
Oh, definitely. Sure. I mean, I don't know how much longer I got to live, and I might not see, my kids might not see it here, and they might get flooded out, but, but you know, I'm happy. I enjoy life. My wife go leave here. We go cruising now and then. We go where we want to go, do what we want to do. And I work. I work a lot, but I do what I want to do. You know, and it's just country living.
That might be a good place to stop, unless you have something else that you want to add.
I'd like to show you some of the pictures if you'd like to see them. But you go ahead and get you a bite to eat.
No,
I know you're
okay. Well, we same time.
Okay.
I want you